Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Paris, 1889. Marguerite Stenhouse is a woman with ambition, but having been born into a middle-class family and trapped in a marriage to a failed artist 20 years her senior, she knows her options are limited. Determined to fashion herself into a new woman, Meg orchestrates a scandalous plan with her most powerful resource, her body. Amid the dazzling glamour, art, and romance of bourgeois Paris, she takes elite men as her lovers, charming her way into the good graces of the rich and powerful. Her ambitions, though, go far beyond becoming the most desirable woman in Paris. At her core, she's a woman determined to conquer French high society. But the game she plays is a perilous one, navigating misogynist double standards, public scrutiny, and political intrigue. She is soon vaulted into infamy in the most dangerous way possible. A real-life femme fatale, Meg influences government positions and resorts to blackmail, and maybe even poisoning, to get her way. Leaving a trail of death and disaster in her wake, she earns the name the Red Widow, for mysteriously surviving a home invasion that leaves both her husband and mother dead. With the police baffled and the public enraged, Meg breaks every rule in the bourgeois handbook and becomes the most notorious woman in Paris. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Red Widow, the scandal that shook Paris and the woman behind it all, with my special guest, historian and author, Sarah Horowitz. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Sarah Horowitz.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so thrilled to be on your show.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this very extraordinary book, The Red Widow. Let's get right to who this incredible woman was. She was born Marguerite Jeanne Jappy in 1869, and her father's name was Edward and her mother, Emily. Tell us about her life growing up.
Yes, so she has a really interesting childhood. Her father is a member of this very powerful and large industrial dynasty in France, the Japy firm. And so he's quite wealthy. He's a member of the bourgeoisie, but he always misbehaves in some ways that maybe, you know, are fine, and in some ways that are not so fine, both by our standards and the standards of the day. And so when he's 26, he falls in love with a 14-year-old girl who is the son, who's the daughter of tavern keepers, so a very humble background. And his family is aghast. He marries her 2 years later. So there is, I think, a 12-year difference between the two of them, as well as a considerable class difference between them. And they were shocked very much by the class difference, although we, of course, would be very shocked and are very shocked by the considerable age difference between the two. They have four children, of whom Marguerite is one of them, as you say, born in 1869. And they live in Beaucourt, which is this town in eastern France that is very much dominated by the Japy family. And so they have this very, Marguerite grows up with this very interesting existence. On the one hand, she is part of the most dominant family of the town and lives in this sort of very beautiful chateau. But the larger family always holds Edward and Emily and their children, including Marguerite, apart because of the sort of scandalous nature of Edward and Emily's marriage. And her father is a very bad manager of money. Marguerite, or Meg as she comes to be known, is clearly his favorite, and she absolutely adores him. She loves her mother, I think, although has a sort of somewhat more distant relationship with her mother. She's often quite disappointed in her mother. And so I think their relationship between father and daughter is quite complicated and quite possibly quite troubling. There are lots of rumors that fly around the town that Edward was sexually abusing Meg. I can't know if that's true, but it does seem clear, even from her own accounts, that there was some sort of sexual charge to their relationship. Marguerite falls in love with a young army officer when she's in her teens. The army officer is a friend of her brother's, is very charming. Everyone loves him. He comes to stay at the house a lot. And he and Marguerite hope that they can marry and maybe sort of like get engaged in secret at a time when engagements were not supposed to be secret and were something that was carefully scripted by families and carefully managed by bourgeois families. There also is some evidence that they have sex before marriage, which is a huge no-no. Her father finds this out, flies into a rage, and sends her to live with her older sister across France. So on the other side of France. And then her father dies soon after, quite tragically and quite suddenly. And it seems maybe that the stress of what he sees as his favorite daughter's betrayal really undoes him. But this leaves Marguerite in a very perilous situation. So there's increasing financial strain because her father has died. Her mother really can't manage all the work it would take to marry her off well. And of course, there's a huge scandal in her hometown about her relationship with this young army officer. So she is, however, pursued by a man named Adolf Stenau, who's an artist who's about twice her age and seems clearly very in love with her and absolutely smitten. She is not so smitten with him, but I think she has few other options and is facing a lot of pressure from her family to marry him. So she marries him in 1890 and goes to live with him in Paris, in his home, where he lives the life of a sort of not terribly successful artist. I would call it a middle-class life. She's never going to go hungry, but it's not going to be particularly glamorous. Their relationship is not happy. She's very ambitious. He's very passive. He's very much in love with her. She is always sort of iffy about him. And also, he is having affairs with both men and women. And those affairs with men really horrify her. For many people of the day, male homosexuality was absolutely horrifying. And so she wants to get a divorce very early on. soon after the birth of their first and only child, but he convinces her not to. Part of the reason is that divorce at the time was so scandalous. And so it was seen as scandalous, a kind of last resort, and would have required airing the family's dirty laundry, including her husband's affairs with men, so that they decide to stay married, live fairly independent lives in the same home. And he basically promises that he will allow her to have affairs, as far as I can tell. And so she starts off on a course of affairs with very prominent Parisians, starting with her husband's best friend, who's a very prominent former jurist. He was essentially the former attorney general of Paris. And he introduces her to this world of high society that she absolutely adores. So there's this young woman. She's in her early 20s. She's very beautiful. She's very, very charming. She's very seductive. She loves male attention. And she does quite well for herself in Parisian high society, having a string of affairs, particularly with men in the judiciary. And the arrangement she strikes with them is fairly unusual, that they will buy a painting from her husband, and in return, she will have an affair with them. So this means that she never has to directly trade sex for money, and is also a way of boosting her husband's career and indirectly her family's prestige. And she's very famous because in 1897, she starts having an affair with a president of France at the time, Félix Faure. And he's absolutely smitten with her. And he sends huge sums of money to her husband to buy this not very great art to finance their relationship. And what Marguerite and Faure are perhaps most famous for is in February of 1889, he has a stroke during one of their sexual encounters. Legend has it at the climax of one of their sexual encounters, but right. I don't know if that's actually true, and then dies of it a few hours later. This is, of course, very embarrassing to her, and it never makes it into the press, or at least she's never named in the press, but everyone in Paris knows about this. She becomes, as a result of their affair, even more famous. You know, people are really excited because they see her as this very talented lover who is so good that she just might kill you.
Right.
And she has a series of affairs with very prominent, very powerful men, including industrialists, some evidence of some kind of, you know, members of royal families. And she has these affairs, but her system is really faltering by 1908. She and her husband are increasingly at odds with each other. She wants to divorce him. And the family is also increasingly under financial strain. And she's having some trouble keeping lovers. And so this is 1908. And in May 31st, 1908, her valet wakes up in the morning, comes down to the second floor of their house, finds her husband and her mother, who had been staying with them, strangled, and Marguerite tied to the bed with a gag by her side, calling out for help. And so the police come very rapidly. They start this search. And Marguerite is the only survivor of this attack and the only witness. And she says that three robed men and a redheaded woman entered the house. They thought it was empty. They were intending to rob it. They realize that the residents of the house are still there. They kill her mother and her husband, but they spare her life, thinking that she is the adolescent daughter. And this is a very improbable tale from the beginning. I mean, you know, Marguerite is sort of on the verge of 40. The idea that she would be mistaken for an adolescent is one problem. But there are also no signs of forced entry in the house. There are no signs of struggle on the corpses of either her husband or her mother. There are valuables that are left in plain sight in the house, including just cash lying out there. And the house is really not in disarray. You know, it looks like some drawers have been rifled through. And so, you know, people read this report and think she has to be lying. And I think any of us would also think she has to be lying it can't have been an intrusion. This wasn't robbers. You know, the fact that there are no signs of struggle are very strange for many people. But the police go along with her. And the police say, yes, we believe her story. And they start trying to find people who match her the description that she gave. And I think it's important to note that she is very, very well protected, that she has so many connections among French politicians, among French officials, and in particular, the chief investigator of the affair, a man named Joseph Lédé. He was at the very least an admirer, but quite possibly one of her lovers.
Right.
So it seems quite likely that the police are engaged in a cover-up. And there are lots of theories about what actually happened. We don't know what happened. The murders remain unsolved to this day. There are some people who think that she might have done it, that she was so tired of being married to her husband and that being a widow was less scandalous than getting a divorce, so she just decides to kill him. The most probable theories, they were having a fight and then her husband wakes up and sort of lumbers towards the lover. The lover freaks out. He thinks he's been, as this is a trap, and he strangles the husband. And then the mother quite possibly just dies of fright. You know, the sort of seeing her son-in-law murdered, essentially. And then after that, she and her lover decide to stage this crime scene. And so they rifle through the drawers. They put a cane by her husband's corpse to make it look like he had defended himself, even though, of course, there are no signs that he had engaged in any struggle. And then they tie her to the bed, or the lover ties her to the bed, but ties her quite loosely, and strangely also ties her to the bed toe by toe, which is a very unusual method of tying someone to the bed, and then puts a piece of sort of cotton wadding by her head to make it look like she had been gagged and cried out. So it seems like this has been staged, very sloppily staged, but just enough so that the police would have enough to say, oh, we believe her account that this was intruders who meant to rob the house.
You talk about the political connections and you talked about this, you write about this lady, this person in charge of the investigation. But at the same time, there are rumors, as you mentioned, and a very effective rumor mill, but also the press.
Yes.
Tell us about the behavior of some of the press and how prominent. You said 79 dailies in Paris at that time, 275 in the provinces. So the role of the media is very important in this story. What's the role and the public's role in this? What happens next?
That's such a great question. So this is, as you say, there's 79 dailies in Paris alone. This is total media saturation, which means that, you know, people would be reading multiple newspapers a day. And they're newspapers for all political stripes, from far left to far right. There's also these four big, fairly not particularly politically engaged newspapers that have huge circulations.
Right.
And so in this era where there's this tremendous press competition, everyone wants a good story. And they love stories about crime. They love stories about female celebrities and sex. And they love stories that have a little bit of political intrigue. So this, immediately after the murders, is front page news. That being said, there's some press norms, so that there's a lot of hints in the press about Meg's relationship with Faure, but for the most part, journalists don't really mention it right after the murders. They still feel that's a little bit off limits, that, you know, the former president deserves a kind of certain degree of respect. And the press very early on points out all the many contradictions of Meg's story. And they're very skeptical. And particularly the left-wing press is very skeptical because they were very skeptical of the police, who they see as basically oppressing workers. And so there's a lot of skepticism. What that means is that Meg is under a cloud of suspicion. And so the public really suspects her. And she has friends and lovers who are saying, we can't have a relationship with you until your name is cleared. So that means that her financial situation is very imperiled because she's dependent on her lovers for money. So she's really desperate to clear her name. It's pretty clear to me that the government just wants to put this case to bed and to say, we couldn't find the murders. Too bad. They're just, you know, these horrible, nefarious criminals. We all know that Paris has experiencing a crime wave. This is just one other terrible thing that criminals have done. And so the authorities stop talking to the press quite within a few weeks about this case and say, there's no news. We don't have anything. This is just a very ordinary crime. The problem, of course, for Marguerite is that she needs more than that, right? She needs perpetrators to be found. But if we assume that either she's the perpetrator or that one of her powerful lovers was the perpetrator, that can't happen. And so she really has a shifting series of stories in the coming months. She blames Germans, Italians, Brazilians, North Africans. And then what happens is a kind of fairly strange coincidence. So the day after the murders, someone who worked in the Parisian metro finds in the Parisian metro card that has an invitation to an exhibit of her husband's artwork. And it also has another card with a list of addresses. And so this metro employee turns this over to the police, thinking it could be a clue. And the police track down all the addresses that's on this sort of supposed clue. And one of them is of a theatrical costumer. And the theatrical costumer says, well, a little bit before the murders, I rented out some robes to a bunch of strange Americans, and they never returned them. And so then the police go after these, they find these strange Americans, one of whom is a journalist, another whom is an artist. And they start following these men, thinking that they could be possibly the murderers. And Meg is, of course, she knows about this. She's so excited. She has these increasingly certain identifications of these men as the perpetrators, as the police show her photographs and also arrange for her to see these men on the streets of Paris. She's sort of dressed up so she wouldn't be visible as herself. She dresses as an errand girl one time. She says, oh, yes, I think it's these men. And the problem for Meg and for the police is that these men have rock solid alibis. And the American journalist had actually been out of Paris. He had been on a essentially hiking trip all over France. And there's a hotel owner who says, yes, he was here that night. He couldn't possibly have been in Paris. And so this is, at this point, Marguerite is increasingly frustrated. She really, really needs to clear her name. And so she goes back to the press and she tells this journalist and says, the police are on the verge of an arrest. Any minute now, they're going to arrest the perpetrators who match my initial description. And the police are very upset with her at this point, because by doing this, she had essentially reopened the case, put herself back in the spotlight after, you know, months of a media silence about the case. And so they say, actually, no, this lead didn't pan out. These men have alibis. But immediately the press seize on this and they're so excited. And Marguerite at this time, she keeps giving interviews to journalists. They're besieging her. They're sort of, you know, there must be sort of probably dozens of them at her house at any one time. She's giving all these interviews. She's making herself, you know, sort of...
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/diagram now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more features like advanced shapes, dependency mapping, and two-way Jira syncing. Get started today at miro.com/diagram now.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm bound and determined to solve these murders and avenge the deaths of my beloved family members. And so she's great copy for these journalists because she's so dramatic and she's so wild. And, you know, she's just so accessible too. And she's a bit of a celebrity. But she runs into trouble and there's no perpetrator. And she's put the news back in the headlines. And so what she does is she plants evidence on her valet. And then when a journalist is over, she has the journalist look through her valet's belongings, find the evidence, and they go to the police and say, oh, the valet must have done it. Because you can see here, he has a piece of jewelry that was stolen on the night of the murders. And so the police throw the valet into jail and he becomes the chief suspect for a few days.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
But then something equally, even more dramatic happens, which is her jeweler recognizes a photograph of the ring she says had been stolen in one of the newspapers and goes to the police and says, actually, I know this wasn't stolen on the night of the murders because Meg brought it to me a few days after the murders and wanted me to reset the stone. And so suddenly, you know, the suspicion starts falling on Meg. Did she plant evidence on her valet? Was she involved in the murders? Why was she lying about what had been stolen after the murders or during the murders? At this point, the case is absolutely front page news of basically every Parisian newspaper. They can't get enough of this story. So she admits that her valet did it. And then very quickly, she says, oh, it was the cook's son who did it. And I've known it all along and I recognized him, but I didn't say it was him because I didn't want to hurt the cook and I didn't want to hurt the cook's feelings, which is an absurd defense that she would shield her cook in order to let the murderer of her husband and mother go.
What was the relationship, though? What was the relationship with this Mariette woman? How long had she been with her? And what was, other than cooking, what was her role in this household?
That's a fantastic question. So the cook, Mariette Wolf, had been working for Marguerite for many, many years. She had been the cook, but she was really sort of the secret keeper for Meg. She had facilitated a lot of her relationships. She had been the one to ask for money from her lovers. She had often, the Marguerite and her husband rent a house outside of Paris, and it's actually where Marguerite takes her lovers. And there it's just Marguerite, her lover, and the cook. So her cook knows all her secrets. And they're very close, which sort of is a problem because Marguerite is accusing her cook's son of a crime he didn't commit. And we know he didn't commit it because he also has a rock solid alibi for the night of the murders. He was at a large dance. And so, you know, hundreds of people saw him. He can't have done it. And the police know this, but they still arrest him. And they drag him to the courthouse. And there's this really dramatic confrontation between him and Marguerite and Mariette, the cook, and her daughter and Marguerite's daughter, and the chief investigator, who is possibly one of Marguerite's lovers. And this goes on for hours, and it's covered absolutely breathlessly by the press, really blow by blow coverage. And finally, the chief investigator, I think he wants to stop her from spinning out any more versions. And at this point, both the press and the public are so enraged at all her lies, and just are so enraged also that the government has gone along with her lies, that he arrests her for impeding the progress of the investigation, for essentially abetting the murderers by doing so, and throws her into the Parisian women's prison. And that's where she remains for a year. The chief investigator very quickly resigns from the case. He sort of says, like, I know that I am in trouble. I know at this point that everyone knows that I was a lover or an admirer, that I took the case just to help her out and to help her clear her name. And the new chief investigator is very suspicious of her and treats her as the chief suspect in the murders. And so it begins a whole new investigation where she is the chief suspect, and quite maliciously on his part, but for a historian, it's wonderful. He feeds so many of his interrogations, so much evidence to the press, who covers in breathless detail, right, what he reveals about Marguerite's affairs, what he reveals about her relationship with her family members. And so for about a month after she's arrested, maybe even 2 months, there's just report after report about all her scandalous behavior in the newspaper.
Let's use this, Sarah, as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear about our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. Certain people just make my life so much easier. I don't know what I'd do without them. Like my podcast engineer, Evan, who takes care of all things technical so I can concentrate just on the interviews. It's like if you own a growing business and you need to hire. ZipRecruiter makes hiring so much easier because they do the work for you. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that makes it easy to filter, review, and rate your candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. In fact, the hardest thing you have to do to remember is our special URL, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's where you go to try ZipRecruiter for free. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Sarah, we were talking about the arrest finally. Meg pushed the police and authorities to finally arrest her. And now you say they had someone that was not so friendly to her, magistrate named Andre. Mm-hmm. Tell us also the unique French judicial system feature where the magistrate has much different than in U.S. judicial jurisdictions.
Yes, this is a really crucial difference in her case. So we see judges as basically sort of, they're supposed to be neutral arbiters between sort of two parties, right? In a civil suit or in a criminal suit, prosecution and defense. The French have a very different conception of what the judiciary does. And one of its functions is to find out the truth. And so the chief investigator is actually a judge and not a police official. He works quite closely with the police, but he's the one who is essentially directing the investigation and in many cases leading the interrogations. And so this is it's a very unique system. It's a very different system. And it also means that the judge who is in charge of the investigation has a great deal of latitude typically to investigate how he would like to investigate. So you see this in the first investigation where Leide, this first investigator who is, you know, her lover, is, you know, basically trying to investigate in a way that is trying to clear her name and protect her from scrutiny. But then the second investigator who really hates her, his name is André, he just tries to make her look as bad as possible and leaks all this information to the press about sort of all the negative information that he finds about her over the course of his investigation. But again, he has enormous latitude to conduct this investigation how he wants. And I think that he overplays his hand so that the public had been really, really hostile to her at the time of her arrest. But as all this information about sort of André's investigation comes out in the next batch of months following her arrest, the public really becomes much more sympathetic to her because they think that André went too far and was too mean to her.
Right.
And really sort of looked into things that he shouldn't have looked into. And so I think, again, this sort of independence of the judiciary is a really crucial feature, as well as the sort of notion that the judiciary's role is to ferret out the truth through lengthy investigations. That's not at all how we see just judges as operating. It's also really important because Meg is so connected to the Parisian judiciary. This, her sort of, her base of lovers were really Parisian judges. And so I think, right, we can also understand why there was such an effort initially to protect her, because she's so protected. She's so connected to that particular world.
You have the journalist at the same time that she's in prison for a year and this trial, and you have that the journalist's silence regarding the affair with Meg and, mm-hmm. and the President Fa mm-hmm. is now public fodder. So
yes.
Tell us the difference in the press coverage of the story that's unfolding with this magistrate and Meg.
Yes. So again, initially, right after the murders, the press they're very quiet about her relationship with this president. They'll sort of hint at it, but they'll say the president was friends with a family, quite typically. But as soon as she's arrested, the press just goes wild with the story. And they print in quite graphic detail sort of their theories of how Fourth died, their kind of what the two were doing in their last encounter. So, you know, there's a lot of information about the sex act that supposedly the two are engaged in during their last encounter, where he has the stroke and then dies. And then there's a lot of information too about, you know, her other lovers, about her sort of ascent through high society, about her family, all these things that in many cases the press had known but had kept quiet. And I think a dynamic here is a kind of dynamic of scandal. So, you know, we've had these other moments where there's a press silence that's broken and then all these stories come flooding out about person's behavior. And I think, for instance, the kind of the press silence, like kind of after there were a batch of stories about Harvey Weinstein and his decades long pattern of sexual assault
right.
and harassment, that all these other stories came pouring out. So I think this is partly just a press dynamic, a sort of dynamic of scandal that we're seeing. But I think the other dynamic is that there was a lot of protection for elites about their private lives.
Right.
That the understanding was rich people, their private lives are, you know, sort of to be kept private. And so I think that's partly what had prevented the press from reporting on this before. But once Meg is in prison, she loses all her status. She's in a prison where she's surrounded by really poor women, you know, women the state treated really horribly, like sex workers. And so she's surrounded by these poor women. She sort of comes to have their status. And as a result, she has all her privacy stripped from her. And so I think that that is the sort of moment of a kind of outpouring that the press and the state really participate in. And so suddenly the public gets all this access to these elite secrets, which had really circulated as gossip among elites for years, but which now become public knowledge and really sort of in, you know, all these papers are reporting on all her different affairs and right her relationship with Fong, again, in quite graphic detail, detail that's fairly shocking, actually, to read now.
What is this scandal known as? And what's the nickname that she earns?
So she is nicknamed the Red Widow right after she's in prison. Red being the color of sex, but also murder, and I think attention, right? This sort of absolutely arresting attention. She also has a lot of other nicknames as well. She's nicknamed the Black Panther, but of course that has different connotations today than it did back then. So she becomes known as the Red Widow. And the scandal becomes known as the Steinhal Affair. Affair in France can refer to both a criminal case, but then also a scandal. And it just absolutely monopolizes public's attention. There are these fascinating documents that I found in libraries and archives, songs that were sung about her, postcards that are kind of imagining her with her lovers, you know, these sort of naughty images of her that circulate in Paris that people buy up as this kind of like memorabilia in a way. And so this case is, Meg is arrested in November 1908. The case is, it's sort of front page news, really, I would say, until January 1909. And then every so often pops back up for the year that she's in jail. And she's finally put on trial in November of 1909 for the murders. And, you know, had she, the sentence that she's facing is she could have been guillotined because that was the method of execution. And she was being tried for capital crimes, right? Sort of killing her husband. And then the crime that is seen as even worse is the killing of her mother, which is under the umbrella of parricide. So killing of a parent, which is seen as one of the worst things you can do because it violates the bonds of family. And so she's put on trial in November 1909. She's interrogated for 3 days by the judge at the trial, and not the judge who had investigated the trial, another judge named Vallès, I think. And he interrogates her for 3 days. He sort of, there's all these witnesses about her family life. Her valet testifies, her cook testifies, some of her lovers testify. The journalists who were involved in uncovering the affair testify. And then, of course, there's lots of police testimony and sort of testimony relating to the physical evidence. And this case, again, is absolutely sort of dominates the front pages of every Parisian newspaper for the sort of more or less 10 days. Doesn't let the judge who's interrogating her get any sort of, never gets a leg up on her. She makes fun of him. She's funny. She's witty. She's cutting. She sometimes is kind of plays up, you know, the tragedy.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It befell her. She's absolutely captivating. And the thought is that she charms really the jury. And she was an incredibly charming woman. And she just turns her attention to them. And that dominates the courtroom. And the state is really never able to prove its case that she did it. I think it's quite possible because, you know, she didn't actually do it. So they can prove that she murdered her husband. And they can prove, not that she murdered her husband. They can prove that she hated her husband and wanted to end their marriage. And she can prove that she lied about what she saw on the night of the murders. But they can't prove anything else. And so she's acquitted. And I think it's this combination of a very weak case that the government brings, but also the enormous public sympathy for her and the degree to which she charmed, you know, at that point, the jury, the journalists, the public just reading the newspaper, that they really sort of loved her at that point and saw her as a kind of exciting, sexy celebrity. So she's acquitted. In November 1909, again, the case remains unsolved. She, after that, has to flee because there's so much press attention. She's a star. She's a celebrity. And she has to flee. So she goes to London and lives the rest of her life. She lives for many decades after in sort of pretty quiet seclusion.
Let's just as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you're talking about that she was acquitted, remarkably, and then she, her mythic image persisted. She lived outside of London, but let's talk about some of the requests that she had and the relationship that someone, an attorney, had seen her at trial and then was smitten. Tell us about her life after and the relationship with this lawyer and how she regained her position in high society.
Yeah. So after the trial, she's a celebrity. Everyone loves her. And so, of course, everyone wants her to sell their products. So she gets all these requests to be on the stage, to star in vaudeville, to kind of advertise products, essentially to, you know, be a celebrity endorser. And she's like a social media influencer in a way. And she also gets lots of, there are all these men who fall in love with her at the trial. And they offer to marry her or to have an affair with her. And she turns down all the commercial offers. So she really wants to regain her privacy. She turns down the offers of marriage. I don't know if she turns down the men who are sort of interested in paying for sex with her. She may say yes or she may say no. But she moves to London. We know that by 1917, she's living in a house sort of in essentially like kind of suburbs of London, a quite large house, a very beautifully furnished house, which suggests that, you know, her husband's estate wasn't much. She didn't have much money afterwards. So my guess is that her lovers are still paying her some money for affairs, still, you know, interested in visiting this kind of alluring, captivating woman. In World War One, she decides to start up a jam factory to make provisions for the troops. And so this is a kind of form of war work. A lot of women engaged in war work at the time to sort of help out or to make some extra money. And at some point in the 1910s, this lawyer, who's a British baron, he had seen her at the trial. He falls in love with her. He proposes to her right after the trial. She says no. And it seems like a few years later, they meet again, at some sort of society event in London. And she takes him up on his offer. And so they marry in 1917. He at the time is serving in the Navy. He's a baron. And, you know, they live, I think, quite nice life. He has a big castle in the Scottish Highlands, and they're sort of redoing that. And they also have a place in Surrey where they live, and they have a quite nice life. We don't know much about their marriage. It seems like she sort of continued to go to parties, but probably was not received in the best circles of British society. It was a bit too scandalous for that. And then he drops dead. 10 years after they're married, he has a heart attack. While she's away sort of with a servant's child at this, you know, giving him a kid a nice day at the seaside. And that puts her in some financial strain again, because a lot of the property goes basically to the heir to the title and not her. So she moves to Hove, which is a British seaside town. I've been told it's very lovely, and lives out as a kind of dowager, you know, sort of going to parties, going to charity bazaars, attending luncheons with friends, receiving visits, visiting people for sort of the kind of next decades of her life until she dies in the 1950s. She refuses to speak to the press. There's, you know, every so often a journalist tracks her down and is kind of really says, like, can you please tell us your story? You know, tell us who did it. Can't you do that now? And she just absolutely refuses. And so she dies in the 1950s, taking her secrets with her.
You talk about, though, the secrets that she published. Her reputation was so important to her that she sued certain publications for saying things for libel. But to assuage that, she wrote her memoirs.
She did.
You had access to that. So how were the memoirs anticipated? And then what was the reaction afterwards?
Yeah, so she publishes her memoirs, I think in 1912. And people are so excited because they know this is coming out. It comes out first in the UK. And they're so excited because they think she's going to reveal all her secrets. She's going to talk about her relationship with the French president, Félix Faure. Maybe they think that she might even say who did it, who committed the murders. But they're a huge disappointment. You know, she really sort of doesn't reveal any juicy secrets. There's some very interesting kind of emotional passages about her childhood and her family. But some of it is just like basically reads like a news report of what happened, you know, in 1889. It's something like no insight, something you could read in a textbook. And she really sort of skims over her relationship with Faure. She says that she was just kind of helping him write his memoirs. And when it comes to the murders, it's even worse in her account. So she blames Jews for the murders. And she had, soon after the murders, kind of floated all these theories that Jews had been responsible and really tried to rile up anti-Semitism in France. And, you know, people don't really believe her. Like the sort of far-right nationalist anti-Semitic press is willing to believe her, but a lot of the kind of the sort of other press organs are just like, no, this woman is nuts. And so, but in her memoirs, she's really kind of trying to say that there was this international Jewish conspiracy that had something to do with Faure, and she doesn't quite know what it is, but that's who killed her husband and mother. And so it's a really nasty conspiracy theory that plays on a lot of horrible anti-Semitic tropes, including, right, sort of ideas about Jews as ugly, as sort of criminal, as, you know, masterminds of an international conspiracy plotting against the nation. And so I think quite fortunately for the time, people just don't like her memoirs. I think they're a disappointment. People are very upset that she's not willing to say who did it, to reveal much, and also that she's still continuing to float these conspiracy theories. That being said, the right-wing nationalist press still picks up on these conspiracy theories, and they really use this crime as fodder for their theories that Jews were a danger to the nation, that they're sort of plotting against people, and that they control the French state. And of course, this is why the murders were never found out. And that feeds into fascist currents in France. And so I think that is the kind of one of the dark side Meg, her whole life, has this propensity for lying. Some of her lies seem kind of harmless, or some are sort of obviously untrue. This one is really harmful and sort of does a great deal of damage in the long run.
You say that Meg became a sexual celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And what we haven't talked about was, when we just skipped over it a little bit, is that her father had trained her in how to speak, how to walk up a stair, how to descend a stair, mm-hmm. her comportment.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about that possibly there was some abuse, but there was mm-hmm. this bizarre relationship that they did have that was far too intimate for mm-hmm. anyone that would look at it. You talk about a sexual celebrity
mm-hmm.
and the effect of Meg, this affair, and this entire story on society.
Mm-hmm. So it's really fascinating. I think that her father, whatever, you know, he may or may not have sexually abused her, but it's clear that there is this sort of sexual charge to the relationship and that he really wants her to be as alluring as possible, while also being very jealous of sort of anytime any other man pays attention to her. So in certain ways, quite horrifying. She sees this as a form of his care, as a form of him loving her. What she does is, I think she learns quickly that a sort of sexualized demeanor is a form of, you know, it can get her attention, can get her sort of things she wants. And so she uses this ability to kind of drop men's attention, to cultivate their, right, sort of their interest in her throughout her life. And I think, you know, we might see this as in some ways making best of what we would see as a very bad situation, that she manages to kind of use this for her own purposes. And so this helps her become a celebrity, particularly, you know, during the trial. I think that, you know, one of the interesting things is about the trial, but also the sort of the scandal in general, is this fascinating series of debates about gender and about women's roles and men's roles, some of which have a lot of resonance today and some of which very much, I think we can say we fortunately have passed them. So, you know, she really plays up how traditional she is at the trial, that she was just a kind of loving family member, that she, you know, if she lied after the murders, it was just to protect her daughter, that she's this loving mother. So she's really playing on these traditional roles. Feminists, interestingly, at the time, sort of try and take her as a hero because she's so smart and she's so eloquent and she's so talented.
Right.
And they say this is proof of that women are actually really smart, right? That they can outsmart like kind of male judges and male officials. It's also, I think that there's this absolute horror at how weak her husband was, that he let her have affairs. He's seen as sort of responsible for her affairs. And also, I think there's some absolute horror for his relationships with men. This was also a kind of sign of moral weakness, of his being kind of corrupt. So I think, you know, it's really interesting to me that some of these ideas really resonate with some of our ideas and some of our debates, right? So often we judge women based on how are they good family members? Are they loving?
Right.
And I think that really resonates. At the same time, I think we also understand sort of that we also have more space for women to have professional opportunities, which there was very limited ability for women to do at the time. And I think we also can say that our attitudes about same-sex sexuality are, for the most part, right, there are a lot more people who would sort of not see this as absolutely horrifying. So I think it's a really interesting case where we see these debates over what men should be like, what women should be like. And, you know, I was in college when the sort of Bill Clinton's relationship with Monica Lewinsky came to light.
Right.
And I just remember it as this time where this, you know, again, the scandal was so kind of centered so much on debates about women should be like, what men should be like, you know, like sort of women in the workplace, women's power, sort of men's authority. And I think there are these way in which scandals really quite often become ways for us to have these discussions and, right, to sort of think about these things in terms of people's behavior, kind of what they should and shouldn't do. So that's just one way in which I think we're sort of very much sort of living in a world that's quite similar to Meg's world.
One thing that struck me was when mm-hmm. you talk about the, again, sexual celebrity, but also that the trial hinged on whether people thought they knew who she was and whether they liked her.
Yeah.
So based on some of the, again, the charm that she exuded, that's why she was successful.
I think it's a combination of her charm and her smarts. And also the state just has a very weak case. They really don't have any evidence that she actually committed the murders. It's all circumstantial. And it's also true that the prosecutor just kind of flubs the case and is really unconvincing as a prosecutor. So I think it's a combination. But I do think, again, there's this way in which we often judge women who are accused of crimes based on sort of whether we like them or not. And so I think that sort of is something that resonates, right? Do they fit what a woman should be? Do we find them charming? Do we find them sort of monstrous? And she really benefits from the degree to which she was able to charm folks. And I think that's still the kind of degree to which we judge female defendants on sort of based on our kind of gut feeling about them, as opposed to necessarily the evidence.
It seemed that she rehabilitated it herself, and then at trial came down to that she loved too much and lost her head and really had rehabilitated herself from this cold-blooded murderer that could have something to do with her mother's murder and the murder of her husband.
Yes, she very successfully, as her defense lawyer, who's also very canny, they really play up that this is just a woman who loved deeply, who's very emotional, very passionate, in a kind of pretty big, you know, coup for a defense attorney. The defense attorney brings back the army officer who was her first love, and then he testifies about how wonderful she was and just how loving she was and how much he loved her and how sort of sweet their relationship was and how she was such a good daughter. And so she really is able to kind of cast herself as this loving figure. Again, I think that we often judge women based on whether we see them as loving or not, based on their sort of their family relationships. So this is this way in which I think this also kind of is very reminded me a lot of some of the kind of cases we see today.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Sarah Horowitz, for coming on and talking about The Red Widow, the scandal that shook Paris and the woman behind it all. This is to be released September 6th. Can you tell us how people might find out more information? Do you do any social media?
Yes. So you can go to my website, which is sarahehorowitz.com, and it has a link to my Twitter account, which is also Sarah E. Horowitz, and my Instagram account, which is a little bit confusingly Sarah.E.Horowitz. And yeah, so people can find me on the internet. My website will have all those links to both Instagram and Twitter.
Thank you so much, Sarah Horowitz, The Red Widow, The Scandal That Shook Paris, and The Woman Behind It All. You
Thank
have a great
you.
Night. Thank you so much for this interview and good night.
Thank you.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.